What are this year's most important but least covered stories? What has the media not been covering that it maybe kind of should have? Today, we will find out on this special year-end edition of the Reason Roundtable. Hello and welcome. As always, this is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I am your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengi Ward, Matt Welch, and very special guest, Robbie Suave. Happy holidays. Happy New Year to everybody. Okay, so this week, as is traditional, we're going to take a look at undercovered stories that matter to libertarians, and we're going to divide this into four categories. There's going to be politics, economics and private industry, world affairs, and then finally, culture. We're going to start with politics. Catherine, let's start with you. What is your undercovered story in the political realm in 2025?
Listen, I am really sorry to be this guy, but I will be picking stories that were covered a lot and yet were still undercovered for at least two of these four topics. And I don't care that that's going to make you mad, Peter. You're not the boss of me. So my pick
I am for 1 hour a week.
That's true. You know. Right now you are. And you can try to punish me if you want. But my answer is tariffs. I know they were covered a lot. I do know they were covered a lot.
Oh, that's really cheating.
And they were still undercovered. It's the only thing that matters, guys. We single-handedly this year wrecked decades of consensus on the importance of global free trade. We just blew that shit up as if it wasn't the most important thing that the world had ever achieved. So we really could not have covered this story enough. Even Reason, which covered this story almost every day of this year, still should have covered it more, and everyone else should have covered it 10 times more.
Wow.
Good morning.
All right.
Happy
that
Monday.
Was not an
That's
undercovered story.
This week.
That was an important story, but it was not undercovered.
It was undercovered.
Let's see if we can do a little bit better, Robbie.
I similarly was going to reject the premise of this
you can't,
whole
I
conversation
did
and the categories.
You have to choose a minor.
But this is
not,
a theme episode.
I have not
We're
done
not
it to this
We're not talking about
degree.
Wicked. We're not talking about Star Wars.
Do you know how hard it is to even decide whether a story is undercovered in this day? Like, somebody's covered it. Also, I just pay attention to the things that are
over-covered.
That are covered.
Robbie's
right?
beat is stories that are overcovered, actually.
I was trying to think of something I had not thought of, which is like a tautology. I couldn't do it. All right. But here on this category, the politics
first
one.
The first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. The first
I'm
rule
sorry.
Of Tautology Club is the first rule of Tautology Club. That's
I have to
I'm
interrupt
thinking.
Robbie again so he can think of something that was genuinely undercovered while I'm talking. And that is to tell you all that my mom bought us a 90s trivia game and we tried to play it in my family. And like one of the first cards was who says the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. And then we just threw the game away because it was so bad.
Wow. Well, that sounds really fun. I would like that game. You should read
should
it
we
me.
Should okay. we talk about undercovered stories?
Politics.
Thank you, Catherine. That was an undercovered story. Your mom bought you a card game.
Yeah. That's an undercovered story, but not an important one. The answer to the question was Tyler Durden, obviously. Trump's immediate loss of the Joe Rogan voters would be my undercovered political story. You remember when Trump won the election a year ago, significantly in some way due to having done the podcast circuit and having spoken to Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, viewers, consumers, voters, young males in particular of every racial demographic, slotting themselves into the GOP. I think Democrats were very worried about that becoming a long-term trend. You heard things like, we need our own Joe Rogan that were really stupid in a variety of ways because Joe Rogan was himself a Democrat at one point who was like ran out of the coalition. But the good news for anti-Trump people is that this does not look to me like it's a necessarily permanent phenomenon or even like a long-term phenomenon. There's already so much griping about everything the administration is doing. If you're watching Joe Rogan with any regularity, they are just like that world is not on board with what they are seeing so
what
far
the,
from 1 year of Trump.
Moments like that got them off the fence and
the immigration stuff has gone way too hard for the kind of barstool conservative type person or whatever we're calling these people. They think like the images that, you know, the Stephen Miller stuff of just like, wouldn't it be great if America was completely white and we deported everyone who doesn't have the last name Miller? That's being kind of unfair to him. A little bit of exaggeration, maybe not really. Yeah, that stuff is not playing with this audience, and then they feel let down on, I think, some of the foreign policy stuff and just a variety of other things. They're not happy, and that is bad news for Trump, good news for other people.
I mean, Joe Rogan has specifically talked about the immigration raids being on workplaces, being just like obviously a bad idea, right? These people came here to work. They are literally working by definition when you pull them out of a workplace. But then also, if you look at the polling on younger voters who flipped to Trump, who he won, who he maybe wasn't expected to win, or sort of were kind of, independent type voters, they're really mad about prices. They're just so mad about prices, which goes back to Catherine's overcovered story, but important story, tariffs. Matt Walsh, what do you have for us?
So keeping on the Stephen Miller theme, at the end of October, the administration set its 2026 annual cap on the number of refugees that are being that will be admitted to the country, or the target, 7,500 for the year. We have never in the modern era, which is the last half century, admitted that few number of refugees into this country. That's fewer than during the COVID pandemic, when everyone was trapped in their house forever and couldn't go anywhere. It's fewer than after 9/11, which was a big traumatic event, Robbie, that you probably don't remember, but it was really sucked for the rest of us. And people were really worried about, I don't know, planes flying into buildings and things like that. It is by far the lowest that we've ever seen or contemplated. Generally speaking, during the era of Carter, Reagan, and H.W. Bush, we would average about 90,000 refugees a year. It was more like 70-ish, 75 during the first 15 years of this century. And now it's going to be 7,500 next year. In a fun twist, Stephen Miller was very proud, literally said, "I am proud," on CNN recently, or one of the cable news shows, that the only source, really, or the main source of those refugees will be white South Africans. Of all the people that we're looking for in the world who are persecuted by their own governments or are displaced people due to conflicts and wars and whatnot, it's white South Africans that we're looking at. A fun fact, super fun, the worldwide total of refugees has doubled in the last 10 years to something around 36 million, depending on how you measure it. And that generally will mean that instead of taking one out of every 70 refugees, as we did under Carter and Reagan in the world, back when America understood that part of its job was to accept refugees from countries that are persecuted its own system, we are now going to take one out of every 5,000. It's changing the character of our country in a way that I think you occasionally see and respond to in the form of a tweet. Stephen Miller spent the holidays literally tweeting about how watching a Christmas movie with Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra made him reflect that it's a bad idea to have immigration from shithole countries.
Which is famously non-immigrant people, right, Matt?
famously non-immigrants. It's all insane, and it only has gotten worse since then. This is changing the character of this country right now, and our moral character, in ways that I don't think that we have paid a lot of attention to.
There's real Boss Baby vibes there, right? Like, guy who's only seen one movie and it's Boss Baby, watches a second movie. And he's like, wow, it's giving me real Boss Baby vibes, right? Like, everything he watches is just like, man, this is giving me real, we should shut out the immigrants vibes.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Terrible movie critic, Stephen Miller. Matt, is that actually going to happen? 7,500? Is that a proposal? Is it going to get stuck in the courts? Like,
no, it's not. I mean, the White House has total discretionary authority to do that, to set those targets. Every president does it. They have broad latitude to figure out how those slots get filled. So this is not one of those cases in which the White House is overstepping its bounds at all. Every president has done this for the last 50 years. It's just that this one this year has said 7,500 is the magic number.
All right. So speaking of numbers, you guys all brought up Trump administration stuff that is bad. I'm going to talk about a hangover from the Biden administration, the EV charging station program that everybody was all sort of a Twitter about, a buzz about for a couple of years, because they spent like $7 or $8 billion and we built like seven charging stations. The goal was to build 500,000 of those. Now, admittedly, 500,000 by 2030, which is not 2030 yet. It's only 2025. But we've built a couple of more. We are now at 384. For $7.5 billion. And it's just, we just keep not building these charging stations with all of these billions of dollars. And in addition to this, the EV market is also kind of not quite collapsing completely, but it is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. The big manufacturers are pulling back on EVs, and they all got subsidies for this. And this was a big Biden administration initiative, whereas we're going to spend billions, not just on the chargers, but on subsidizing these factories, subsidizing the upstart companies that are going to make these electric vehicles. And look, there is nothing wrong with electric vehicles. I like them. They're fun to ride in. They're nice and quiet, which I like, and I think is an underrated virtue of electrical vehicles, especially if you live in a big city. But adoption needs to come through the market. And the government is spending billions of dollars on charging stations that do not get built, on subsidies for cars that people don't want. And that is not the right way to make electrical vehicles happen. It wasn't right for Biden. It's not right now that Trump is president. And people are just not talking about this enough, that like this program has not worked. Like, these types of programs do not work. You can't make whatever happen, right? This is underpants gnomes theory of electric vehicles. Spend billions. Adoption. And like, no, it just doesn't happen. Okay, so we're going to move on to our next category, economics and private industry. Undercovered stories, not stories that we've heard about 1,000 times. Do you have one that people haven't maybe heard about, Catherine?
I do. This one's a real undercovered story. Not that my last one wasn't, because my last one also was. Okay. I feel attached to the ability of people to make transactions in cash. There's two kinds of libertarians. There's the kind that are like, screw it, it's Bitcoin or bust, or, you know, we're just all going all digital, privacy is over. I have a lot of sympathy for those people, but I think the ability to buy and sell things using cash money is an important bulwark for privacy and personal freedom. And so I want to talk about a new rule that happened earlier this year, I think February or March, where in several counties around the Mexican border, the threshold for cash withdrawals or transactions that have to be reported to the federal government was dropped from 10,000, which Reason has covered this a bunch. If you do transactions of more than $10,000, you know, with a stack of cash, your bank has to tell the feds about it. Sometimes if you do transactions that are smaller than that, that add up to 10,000, your bank still has to tell the feds about it. I think structuring, right? That itself is a crime. In fact, if you try to do things to avoid triggering this reporting requirement, you may have committed a crime, or at least it'll be stacked on top of other charges. But
like, very specifically, the people who get in trouble for this, for those who don't know what structuring is basically you run a business that does a lot of cash, that involves a lot of cash, and you deposit $9,000 4 days a week into your bank. And so that just barely doesn't hit the threshold. And then the feds come after you for doing business and depositing your money in a bank. And even though you weren't hitting the threshold, you weren't actually over $10,000. You were pretty close to it. So they think that you are somehow or another trying to run drugs or cash or do something illegal, and you can get charged for this for having done absolutely nothing illegal. It's every single time I hear about this, it makes me enraged.
Yeah, I'm glad you share my I should be able to privately do stuff with my cash rage, because I think it is important. In several counties near the border, because the cartels, which is the justification for everything, that threshold has been lowered to $200. So if you take $200 out of your bank account in one of 30 zip codes in California and Texas, you will now potentially be subject to a geographic targeting order from the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN. That's insane.
That's insane.
We should be angry. This is Americans doing American banking in America with their dollar bills that say, "In God we trust" on them. What the heck, guys? Get mad about it.
So this is for taking out money, not just depositing?
This is transactions involving over $200. The threshold is
$200. So if you pull $400 out of your ATM to go buy speakers from a guy on Craigslist, like you do sometimes.
If you were that guy, yeah. Yes. So for many months this year, it's been $200. They did issue an amended version of this order that raised the threshold to $1,000, which is still $9,000 less than it was, and still many, many thousand dollars less beyond that than it should be.
Fun fact about that $10,000 rule, it was passed sometime around 1970, let's say, as part of our war against the mafia. $10,000 in 1970 is the equivalent to around $85,000 today, adjusted for inflation. So it was a lot of money back then. It ain't now because of the degraded currency.
Because of inflation. Matt Welch, what's your undercover
globally,
story?
Globally, worldwide, we have as a globe, recovered finally from the pandemic effects on travel and tourism. People are traveling more than ever. They're spending more than ever. Oh, wait, everywhere except one big place. Can we guess what that one big place is? It's the United States of America. We're the only major tourism destination. We're still the number one tourism destination when it comes to money spent. We are the only one that is getting less tourism, international tourism, than other places. And the reason that we're getting less is because we acted like jerks to the rest of the world. So Canada in particular, which is the second biggest source of foreign visits here, cut that down by 26% because they're really mad about the whole 51st state stuff and all the big tariffs and Trump acting like a jerk all the time. And other countries followed suit, Western Europe in particular. Right now, at the current rate that we're going down, we are going to be replaced as the world's number one destination for tourism by what country by 2031? Red China. That's the direction that we're going to right now. It's the kind of thing that people, you know, who cares? I don't like tourists. It's a very unseen type of thing, unless you happen to work in the hospitality industry in Las Vegas. Then you see it a lot. Or in Florida, which has seen a huge hit, especially of those aforementioned Canadians who used to like to go down there in the winter months. And the Trump administration is going to increase its hostility towards foreign visitors very soon by doing stuff like looking at prospective visitors' social media accounts. That's a rule that's scheduled to go in effect in the first few months of this year, and also adding to fees of people, even from visa waiver countries, before they come into this country. In 2026, we're going to have the World Cup. We're going to have the obviously the semi-quincentennial celebrations that's going to get everyone pumped up. But we're seeing fewer international tourists. And as a direct result, for those who care about such numbers, and I'm not really one of them, we have what is now known as a tourism trade deficit. We used to have a surplus in that. We'd like more people came here than we would go there and spend monies. And that is now reversed for the first time. So congratulations, America. Fewer people want to come here and spend their money and give to what is a semi-trillion dollar or $3 trillion travel and tourism industry in the United States.
I just returned from Miami yesterday, and I will say that my anecdotal observation was certainly not less tourism, but I'm aware that that matters nothing statistically.
I mean, it's hit Las Vegas pretty hard, but also there have been, you know, other effects in Canada, for example, and this is partly because of the tariffs. You basically cannot buy American whiskey right now. And so this has been like a huge hit to the American whiskey industry, which the American whiskey industry, which is hurting already for other reasons, not just because of the tariffs, but the tariffs have made it much harder to do exports for whiskey. And in Canada, they've basically taken all of the American whiskey off of the shelves. Canada hates America right now. And that was not necessary. Like, that was an unforced error, and it is hurting American businesses. Robbie, what do you have for us in economics and private industry undercover story?
Like Catherine, I chose a financial transactions type story, actually. I feel like this was the year, obviously this has been around longer than that, the buy now, pay later, Klarna, those things. I feel like this was the year they became mainstream enough to attract moral panic, which is something that happens to everything eventually. This was the year of, you know, the Vox style, what did they call them? They said it's more dangerous than ever. I read a New York Times opinion piece from some woman who racked up $50,000 in Klarna debt, and oh, it's so horrible, this could happen to me. What happened? What happened? It's no different than a credit card. It's the same thing as a credit card. Minor differences.
What does Klarna stand for?
Sorry. Oh, it doesn't stand for anything. It's the name of a buy now, pay later service. When you go to buy something online, it might say, would you like to pay, instead of right now, pay in 4 installments over some period of time. That's Klarna is the service that provides that.
Imagine an internet-based payday lender that mostly works directly through e-commerce and e-retail, so that like it's not like a thing you have to sign up for like an app on your phone. It's like when you go to the Banana Republic website and you want to buy a sweater, it's instead of paying $80 for it, you pay $20 every month for 4 months.
And that is the main option that I believe it has no interest, although if you make a payment, then it starts charging you a late fee. There are other structured plans where there is interest. You should always check those things. I don't think it's, you know, good for people to go massively into debt, but you can do that with a credit card too. You can do that with student loans. You can do that with all sorts of things. So there's no, and also this is a self-corrective problem, right? As long as the incentives are there, as long as it's the company, Klarna itself, that is carrying the burdens of this risk and not like, oh no, we made all these loans we shouldn't have made. Now we need a bailout. That would create a tremendous problem. And I'm, you know, worried after in the wake of Silicon Valley Bank and all those other things that there will always be people saying, oh no, we did this thing that didn't work out. Now subsidize our risk. And that would be very bad. But as long as it's just the risk being carried by the company or by the individual lenders, it's not the government's job to protect you from your own maybe unwise purchases you are fully capable of making, as most people do with most purchases they make is on a credit card. It's exactly the same thing, and we're seeing moral panic, and there's no reason for it.
For those who might be concerned about a service like this, I imagine there are at least some of our listeners who think, I don't know, that sounds a little dicey. Go back and read Catherine Mengu Ward's excellent reporting on payday lending. Payday lending, it's like, I think you can make a case that it's like, if you are getting a payday loan, that might suggest that you have some sort of financial distress or difficulty in your life. And maybe it's not the ideal option. We would prefer, like, if you are a successful person, you don't exactly want to go to a payday loan lender. But the alternatives are worse. The alternatives are worse, and this gives people flexibility to manage their finances. And if you look at like the high quality research, copious high quality research on payday lending, what do you consistently see? When states ban payday lending, the poor people are worse off. And this is the same thing here. Poor people are going to be worse off when they have less flexibility to manage their own finances. Speaking of people who are going to be worse off, DC restaurant workers and people who go to restaurants in DC. So there have been an increasing number of restaurant closures in Washington, DC. This is my choice of a political and economics undercovered story. So there were more than 70 restaurant closures in 2024, and there were close to 100. I think there were 92 restaurant closures in Washington, DC in 2025. And this is pretty straightforward. Some of the reasons for this. It is because of the proposition, basically, that required restaurant employers to pay their workers as if they were sort of normal workers rather than tipped workers, right? And like that just massively, massively increased the labor costs, which are already sky high in the restaurant industry. If you've ever looked at restaurant industry books, the labor costs are just so huge that go into your food. I mean, like, so if you think about like running a bar, which I do every now and then, right? The industry standard for drinks, for cocktails, is that your pour cost, that is the cost of just the liquid in your glass, is 18% of the cost that they charge you. So if it's a $10 cocktail, then the ingredients should only cost $1.80. That's because the rest of it is a little bit of profit and a whole lot of labor that goes into keeping that business open, pouring, not just pouring the drink, but like all of the prep, especially for high quality, high end cocktails, all of that stuff, right? And that sort of thing just goes all the way through the restaurant industry. And so when you raise the labor costs, as they have done in Washington, DC, that just makes it really, really, really difficult to keep a restaurant open, and in particular, to keep a mid-range restaurant open. Very expensive fine dining is doing pretty well in Washington, D.C., but the restaurants that are hit the most are the restaurants that are sort of middle end, not quite the very cheap, you know, sort of street food, not or sort of competing with fast food, but the middle end of restaurants, the kind of small businesses that are local corner pubs, that sort of place, those are getting hit really hard by all of this. And guess what? It looks like we're going to have a vote, maybe, not for sure, but it looks like there's a good chance we're going to have a vote in Washington, D.C. this year, I should say next year, 2026, on raising the minimum wage to $25 an hour. It's not great. It's not great at all. Okay. Thank you all for listening here. We are going to take a break. Before we go to our break, I do want to remind you that most weeks we like to answer your questions. Please send your questions short, succinct, pithy, not very long, to podcasts@reason.com. We're going to be right back after this. Hey, Reason listeners. Do you want to help a student think clearly in the age of AI? Reliance College invites students aged 16 to 24 to the Great Connections Weekend Seminar. Reason and Power. It's going to be held from January 9th through 11th in 2026 at the Hilton Houston Plaza Medical Center. This immersive three-day experience builds the skills no algorithm can replace: clear reasoning, persuasive communication, and independent thought. Students explore great works by Ayn Rand, Epictetus, Machiavelli, and more. Sessions are held in small, dynamic groups. You can develop the habits of mind that drive real innovation. This is not a lecture. It is a conversation, and it changes how you think. Registration is just $99.99 with scholarships available. You can learn more and apply at reliancecollege.org/seminar. That's reliancecollege.org/seminar. All right, let's go to our third category of undercovered story. This is world affairs, what has been happening around the globe beyond America's borders, whenever people are allowed to go beyond them. Catherine, let's start with you.
This is a good news story because I've been bringing some bad news onto this podcast. I want to talk about Nepal, where there was a very... What? Oh, Robbie also wanted to talk about Nepal. Too bad, sucker. Once again, I am first.
Oh, my God.
We can talk about it together because it's a really cool story. So in Nepal, there's a socialist government. They banned social media, like two dozen platforms. And the Gen Zs rose up. They took to the streets and they won. Robbie, do you want to talk about how they won?
I'm going to come up with something different in the next 30 seconds.
Really?
So go ahead. You can
do the
whole
thing. Okay, I'm impressed with you. Then I will talk about it. So the Gen Zs rose up and they took to the streets and they wrested the current holders of power from their position using primarily Discord. They organized this entire revolution on Discord. And then
while they were playing Diablo 4?
Basically. And then they picked a new interim leader on Discord. 100,000 people on Discord were like, we gotta figure out who to put in charge. And they did it. They organized it that way. So I, many years ago, read a book which was called Infomocracy. I might have even talked about it on this podcast. It basically posits this. It suggests the idea that we might kind of have like a caucus system, except for it's on the internets and everyone chooses their political leaders by acclamation online. So it was an example of a very cool, like a thing I read about in a science fiction book kind of happened in real life. And the fact that it was young people and that they rose up in response to threats to their free speech, I think is super inspirational and also suggest that maybe someday, somehow, we will get past having elections, which remains a kind of garbage way to select the people that lead us, except for all the others, as they say.
And the reason it was of interest to me also is I think it should serve as a cautionary tale for all legislators in the U.S. or anywhere else who are thinking, what regulations should we place on social media? How should we make these products that are well-liked and used by everyone, including and especially young people, restrict their access to that? How will they feel about that? There's a lot of assumptions by authority figures that this is a good thing. This is in their best interest. Well, they tried it in Nepal. Granted, it was an authoritarian communist government doing it for very explicitly censorship reasons, but censorship is a goal and is at the heart of what a lot of these decisions actually are in practice. You know, the good faith efforts to root out misinformation end up targeting legitimate political speech. The kids in Nepal didn't like it. I don't know why the kids in America would be any different there.
So Josh Hawley should not try to ban Discord because maybe people will, the youth are going to use it to like rise up and overthrow the government. I think Josh Hawley would look at that and be like, actually, they shouldn't have Discord.
Well, but what Rand Paul said in response to Josh Hawley trying to do this is, I think the kids will rise up and never vote for Republicans again if we are the ones associated with the movement to do this. And in fact, there's some evidence that Donald Trump benefited from the in the election from the perception that he was saving and or bringing back TikTok, framing that TikTok itself leaned into versus Joe Biden and the Democrats that had tried to get rid of it. Even though it was Trump's idea initially, you get the point.
I do want to note this was not a bloodless revolution. So people did die, including a couple dozen people who were protesters who died from gunshot wounds. Right. So this was in many ways also as much as it was a digital revolution, it was also just the good old fashioned people getting shot in the streets, including a 12-year-old who was because there were a lot of very young people and even children in the streets in these protests. So that is. I said it was a good news story, and it is, but all good news stories have downsides.
It was not vibes, yeah, white papers, essays.
It turned out the revolution was not vibes and white papers. Yeah.
I mean, the lesson from this, or one lesson from this, is just that you don't know what a technology is going to end up being used for, and that should give regulators caution. Regulators are so confident that they know exactly how every technology, even things that are barely exist in the world. They're like, no, we know exactly how that's going to work. And therefore we're going to regulate it. We're going to ban it. We're going to do whatever. We're going to sort of exercise political control over this. And like Discord was, I mean, I made a joke, but Discord first came to prominence just as a place where you could talk to your friends about and while playing video games. And that was the origin story of Discord. And now it's the kind of the place where people are meeting to talk about overthrowing authoritarian governments. And that, I think, is a good segue to my undercover story in world affairs, which is that Europe is rolling back or trying to roll back some of its tech regulations in hopes of competing more on artificial intelligence. So as most listeners probably know, the EU has over the past 10 years or so passed a slew of tech regulations with the aim of setting the standards for tech. They kind of wanted to be the California of the world, and the way that California's more aggressive regulations often set standards kind of by default for product manufacturers in the United States. And their idea was, we're going to regulate first before AI is even really a thing. And then all of AI will have to conform to our regulations. Well, guess what happened? We just built AI in America and in China, and it didn't conform to their regulations. And now they don't have a tech industry to speak of. And they're kind of mad about that. And they're also worried about it. And so they're starting to just to try to think about how to loosen this stuff just a little bit. I am not at all convinced that this loosening of regulations is going to do much for the European tech industry. But here is a quote from Emmanuel Macron, the top guy, the president, whatever, of France. We have to innovate before regulating. The top guy, right? He's the number one guy.
The main dude of France.
He's a number one king of New York, except France, right?
Yes.
We have to innovate before regulating, and we have to protect not to be overwhelmed by non-European competitors, because if we let Americans and the Chinese have all the champions, we may have the best regulations in the world, but we won't be regulating anything. That's right. I mean, again, I don't think that this rollback is going to work very well, but that is rhetorically, directionally correct. Maybe they're learning just a little bit. Matt Welch, what do you have for us?
I've got bad news, which is that in 2025, yet again, one of the deadliest, bloodiest conflicts in the world still managed to be pretty underreported, and that is the civil war in Sudan. It is the third or even second deadliest conflict behind the Russia versus Ukraine war, and depending on numbers, which are hard to figure out, Israel and Palestine, which of course now is over-ish. We'll see about the future. The Sudan thing has no prospects currently of being over. It could be 20,000 people die this year, could have been 50,000. It's really kind of hard to say. It's been for like the last 2.5 years since the people who did the coup, military coup in 2021, squabbled amongst themselves and have been killing each other, especially in Khartoum. For a long time, there's terrible internal refugee problem. There's 12 million refugees in the country who've been displaced out of their homes. Famine is spreading. I think one of the reasons why it hasn't gotten as much attention is that there isn't as obvious a story for the bigger international consumers of news to sort of point at their own country. America feels like they're more intimately involved in both the Ukraine-Russia conflict and in Israel-Palestine. And it just kind of doesn't fit into a lot of people's narratives. But it is nonetheless very, very bloody. It's been, in some, one way or another, been going on in Sudan since 2008. 1.5 million people have died. It's very depressing. And not a lot of people have great ideas. We've done some sanctions towards people who are selling weaponry. The United Arab Emirates is the biggest scofflaw, if you believe in such restrictions, out there. But no one really has any good ideas. People are dying on a daily basis while the world doesn't pay too much attention. And that is bad.
Yeah, it's dark. And you hear stories like that and you just, it's tough to process, but it also, it gives me at least a kind of great thankfulness that I live where I live, that I was lucky enough to be born in the United States and to live here and now in this time. Robbie, do you have some better news for us, I hope?
No. What I was going to add is also kind of grim. That Nepal story, as I was doing research for that, it was covered very, very well by Reason's Matthew Petty, who does terrific reporting on international affairs, including that there is still an active U.S. presence in so many countries that we have supposedly wound down combat operations in, including in Syria, where it was in the news. It was covered very recently that American service member was killed in a country that Trump has said we're getting out of, that they now we have a there is leadership in that country post Bashar al-Assad, leadership that is Western friendly and Western aligned, or at least purports to be that way. For some reason, that's not making us less involved over there. In fact, I believe the administration wants to have a stronger troop presence there for a variety of reasons. The question being, why are we there? Is it authorized by Congress? Is it just at the whims of this administration and the next administration? This is a president who ran on and promised to end wars, said ending foreign wars. That was part of his appeal to a lot of people across the political spectrum. That is not the story in Somalia, Nigeria, Syria, so many other places. Worth keeping in mind, unfortunately.
Yeah, and maybe we're going to invade Venezuela like anytime as we're recording this podcast, just because, who knows, this is what Trump keeps threatening. Now, when we talked about the Syria story and the new attacks on Syria last week, you know, I was doing a little bit of research before the podcast and said this on the pod, but I'll just say it again. Like, I was just Googling around for White House statements on bombing Syria, and like the third result was a White House statement on bombing Syria from 2014 when Barack Obama was president. We got to find a way to get out of this. And I think that way is we're going to talk about an undercovered story in culture. We're going to get out of this on this podcast, sadly, not in actual real life. But Catherine, you have an undercovered story for us in the realm of culture.
I do. And it is, this is the other one that you might want to fight me on, but I think I can make the case that it's genuinely undercovered, which is it's the impact of age verification on social media on adults. So I think we've had like just an insane amount of coverage about whether we can save the children from themselves by somehow having Senator Hawley check each individual child's phone at 7 p.m. every night to make sure they haven't looked at YouTube shorts for more than 45 minutes or whatever. I don't know. It's happening everywhere. Every state has multiple bills about this. Reason has covered it, especially in Elizabeth Nolan Brown's Sex and Tech newsletter.
We're just going to create like an AI John Haidt, right? And he's going to be everywhere. There's going to be AI John Haidt in every data center.
He's making a list, checking it twice.
I mean, to be honest, though, that product I would buy. Like, if I could purchase AI John Haidt to net nanny my kids' phones, I would seriously consider having that product. That sounds useful. And in fact, those products do exist. As my children have reminded me occasionally, Instagram has teen accounts now, Mom. I don't care. You still can't have Instagram. But there are many, many tools for parents to use to restrict their children's time online and on different apps and different platforms. Actually, many adults already use those same tools for themselves or similar tools for themselves as well. You can install things on your phone that will be like pop up a little notification that's like, did you really want to spend the next 18 hours on TikTok? Maybe not. so many tools to do it voluntarily, but this has not stopped politicians everywhere, both at the federal and state levels, from trying to do this at the point of a gun. And the most favored tool has been age verification, something where you have to prove how old you are before you can have access to certain content. Always, 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 when a law is for the children, it is actually about restricting adult behavior. And this is a great example of that. I don't know about you guys, but maybe I don't want my driver's license, my government name, my social security number associated with everything that I do online. I might not want that. And that is what age verification essentially requires. So if you would like to consume forbidden content of any kind, if you would like to do, to use certain apps, whatever it is, and you have to put your government name on it, you have really taken away people's adult right to be anonymous on the internet. And I think the internet was founded on that. It should continue on that principle. Plenty of places on the internet where everybody wants to be on the up and up. Plenty of places on the internet where adults should have the right to be on the, I was going to say on the down low. And actually, I stand by that. So the impact, the underappreciated impact of age verification on adult online behavior, I hope we talk about it more in 2026, because that is what this is really about. It's what it's always really about, controlling you, an adult, not just saving the children.
If folks who are watching racing with thoughts of what weird shit Catherine's doing these days.
Between that and me wanting to do a bunch of cash transactions, I realize I do sound like I had a shady 2025. I swear to God, I didn't. I'm very wholesome.
I mean, or a very successful 2025 that you just don't want Josh Hawley and the IRS to know about.
I don't want them to know about all the porn I'm buying with my cash, okay? Jeez.
Just remember, if they approach you, someone online, and wants to sell you explosives, that it is a government agent 9 times out of 10.
Thank you,
just,
Robbie. I appreciate
general
that.
General reminder, we don't want to have you to me. January 6th yourself here.
Not just to me, but to all of our listeners. Yeah. That's good. That's good advice.
In fact, they caught the January 6th pipe bomber by first tracking his location and then figuring out who bought stuff at Home Depot by looking at his credit card records. It was because he couldn't buy it in cash like Val Kilmer did at the beginning of Heat when he wanted to rob that truck with the bearer bonds in it, right? Like, that's the first scene of Heat, or one of the opening scenes is Val Kilmer. He's buying the stuff, and right, they kind of check his fake ID, but like, he just buys it, and like, you can't do that anymore. You buy the stuff in the credit cards, and the feds will, many years later, eventually get you. If people are actually concerned about the age verification laws for adults and their effect on how adults can use the internet, just look at what's going on in Australia. Google it right now. We don't have time to sort of go into this in great depth, but it is, Australia is the sort of the canary in the coal mine here, the kind of the first mover on a really, really strict age verification law. And it's clear that it is requiring adults to put in a government ID to read Substacks about wine. I mean, just stuff like that, that is totally crazy.
Not that.
That is going to allow that. But that is giving the government. It's not just that it is requiring that you verify your identity, that it's making it impossible to be anonymous. It means now the government is going to have records of everything you look at and do online.
There is no way make it a list.
No way that turns out well.
Yeah, I'd say I'd remind people that it's bad. Also, frankly, for young people, what kind of society are we going to live in if we seriously restrict young people's access to social media where all news and information is contained these days? Are we really creating like an informed, you know, soon to be citizens by putting how do we even decide what's a social media? I mean, if you look in these laws, it's very crazy whether YouTube is in, Facebook's out, blah, blah, blah. Very, very terrible.
We're going to subsidize local news operations and send every kid in America like a copy of the Bangor, Maine paper.
We need more evening papers is what we need for the teens. Yeah. That's going to solve it.
All right. Matt Welch, do you have an undercovered story in culture for us?
I do, and I'm going to pose it by way of lightning round questions for all of you. Same question. What? Catherine, first thing comes to mind, biggest box office hit in the world this year. Go.
The Avatar movie, probably?
Nope.
With the
Robbie,
fire?
Go.
No.
I don't know. Was the Marvel movie the Thunderbolts?
Nope.
No, Deadpool.
It's Nazan 2?
It is nay, right? Shot two.
Because I follow box office reports for kind of a...
I don't even know what those
other,
words are.
Right? Like, yes, it's one of these like anime things. There was an anime film that opened in September on a weekend that nobody paid attention to in the United States, that here in the United States just like dominated a weekend that normally people don't go to the movies very much. $70 million opening weekend. That's Marty Supreme's entire budget.
So Nezat 2 grossed $2.2 billion worldwide. I totally had heard of this movie before this morning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure.
It's Chinese animated something or other. It's a sequel to a 2019 film. The original subtitle, if translated, and I wish they would have used it here, is "The Demon Child Churns the Sea." I think Robbie would absolutely crush a Demon Child Churning the Sea animated semi for adults. It's based on some Chinese folklore. Highest grossing animated film in history. That $2.2 billion is in the top five in nominal, obviously not inflation adjusted terms, because as we all know, Gone with the Wind still dominates that category. But just gigantic. And it's the first time really that we've had a foreign film dominate the or non-Hollywood, non-English language originated film dominate the international box office. And that's just kind of interesting, I think. And that we don't know about it. Most of us who aren't total nerds like Peter Sudeman is also kind of interesting, perhaps suggesting that the American Hollywood's stranglehold on the world's audiovisual entertainment is not as strong as it used to be. And Red China can even compete on some of these things.
I like how many of your comments. Yeah. I just like how many of Matt's comments involve inflation adjustments.
Because I'm not a savage, Peter.
Yeah. I bet you also.
Because you're talking about things that are old.
And he puts on his dinner jacket after five. Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah. Come on.
All right. I think that's actually a good setup for my culture story. My culture story is the rise of something called microdramas. You probably haven't heard about microdramas yet, but you are going to. So these are ultra low budget series made for the web, usually for YouTube. They're often soap operas. I mean, literally soap operas, kind of targeted at women, very relationship oriented, right? Sort of simplistic stories, lower income demographics, but they are expanding, especially in the coming year, into sort of more male targeted genre stories, crime, action, mystery, science fiction. I mean, and like, to be clear, when I say that these are targeting women, that these are soap operas, these are the terms that the creators are using. They're talking about, oh, we want male viewers. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make crime stories and science fiction, because that's what dudes like. Dudes like crime and science fiction and mystery, right? I know not all dudes, and some ladies like that too, but what's really interesting about these is that in some ways they're fulfilling the promise of, do you guys remember Quibi? Quibi,
oh,
right?
No.
Which launched during the pandemic. And gosh, it was this sort of disaster streaming service built on short episodic filmmaking. Now, part of what Quibi's mistake was everything they produced was quite expensive. They advertised having programming movies or sort of feature-like programs split into 10-minute chapters that cost $100,000 a minute. So you are looking at, you know, relatively expensive Hollywood productions, not Avatar level, but that's a professional production. And these series are made for much, much, much less than that. I mean, you're talking about $250,000 to do an entire series, an entire storyline, which is just not a whole lot of money in Hollywood terms. But what that means is these creators, the people who are writing these things, are going to be able to take a lot of shots on goal. They're going to be able to do a lot of stuff cheaply. And we are going to see a YouTube ecosystem for storytelling that I think is going to start to resemble the kind of old pulp magazine ecosystem from the 1920s and 1930s, where you just had a lot of these kind of trashy magazines churning out romance and crime and science fiction. And you know what? A lot of it was trash. A lot of it was kind of forgettable. It was definitely just like, oh, this is fiction for women. This is fiction for dudes. It's cheap. It's throwaway. It's formulaic. Absolutely it is. And also it gave us Isaac Asimov. Also it gave us the entire golden age of science fiction. It gave us some great Westerns that were then turned in some cases to some really classic movies. And that that world of cheap filmmaking has kind of disappeared from Hollywood, where like everything, I mean, you know, I just mentioned Marty Supreme's budget. Marty Supreme is a ping pong movie. That's just like a little character study. Yes, yes, it looks really good. Then they like redressed a couple of streets in, you know, in New York, which is an expensive thing to do. But this is like a little character study, kind of like one actor, not one actor, but like a, it's not like a big science fiction effects film. And it cost $70 million to make. And that means that the producers of that type of film are just not able to take many shots on goal. And there's a kind of creativity and a sort of like you can take chances, you can take risks when everything is really cheap. You think of somebody like Roger Corman, who, you know, was sort of the king of like cheapo monster movies in the 1970s. He helped incubate filmmakers like Martin Scorsese, like James Cameron. Can anybody here on this podcast tell me the name of James Cameron's actual first directorial feature? I'll tell you, it's not The Terminator. It's not The Terminator. It was made.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us, Peter?
Yeah. Piranha 2, The Spawning. Piranha 2, The Spawning gave us the guy who eventually went on, like not even a decade later, to make Terminator 2, the first $100 million movie, which made all the money. And then eventually Titanic and Avatar, Avatar 2 and Avatar 3. He's going to become the first person ever, the first director ever, to make four movies in a row that gross $1 billion at the global box office. And like, he got to start working for Roger Corman. And I want to see a world in which people can get their start doing cheap stuff. Because that just means that more people are going to have more opportunities. I think that is going to be a better, healthier ecosystem for storytelling, for Hollywood, for filmed entertainment.
Peter, right. Titanic was also the answer to one of the questions in the 90s trivia game. Thank you.
Speaking of shots on goal, Peter, and also trashy new micro genres, I was made aware over this holiday that there is a steamy romance subgenre aimed at women of trashy romance novels that are all about hockey.
Oh, I watched
We've been discussing that in the office.
I watched it. The gay hockey show.
Heated Rivalry.
Oh, there's a gay hockey show too?
It's on HBO, right?
Decidedly heterosexual. Melting the Ice is Icebreaker. Another one.
The main one is Heated Rivalry. It's gay. But it is for women for some reason. I don't understand, but...
That's,
I think it's for gays.
Do you know what they're calling hockey rinks now?
Oh, no.
Boy aquariums.
I mean,
you watch them swim around in there inside the glass.
If we're doing the thing.
You want to go to the boy aquarium? Sure.
Is this what you've been spending your cash on, Catherine?
I learned about this from New York Magazine, like God intended.
Okay.
I mean, this goes back to the slash fiction that has been part of fanfic for decades, going back to the 1970s, where it started off with Kirk and Spock gay romances. And then, you know, once you had the Kindles come out and the rise of ebooks, you had these folks, these writers like Chuck Tingle, right, who like basically just specialized in monster porn and like dinosaur sex stories that were aimed at young women who understood that they were trashy but enjoyed them anyway. There's a great Slate story on this from about a decade ago. I'm just going to read you some headlines, some story titles that like stand out here.
Did you have this ready?
What are we doing right now?
Are you prepared?
Home run into me. What?
Please, I'm begging you. We're all begging you. We're going to have our producer censor that. Reason doesn't believe in censorship, but also just boop, 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 boop.
35 seconds of boop is fine in this case.
All right, I changed my mind. Social media needs aggressive age verification.
This show.
We'll set the age at 90, and if you're under 90, you can't consume it.
This is in Slate.
This stuff obviously
it's a reputable
isn't on social
magazine.
Media,
this is
books.
A decade-old story.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. I think we have one more undercovered story.
Yeah, I have a real one, not a just spouting off about some entertainment product. Don't watch Heated Rivalry. It is hardcore, just putting that out there.
Let me not ask a follow-up question.
It's
go ahead.
It's just pornography.
That's not... Okay.
Well, that's fine. Just warning you against it if you don't want to watch that kind of thing. Okay, my story, a serious one. AI, we're talking obviously about how AI is changing society and regulation and all that. We need to consider how Section 230 will apply to artificial intelligence. Section 230, probably many of our listeners are aware of, as we write about it a lot, is the thing that makes social media possible. It grants a broad liability immunity from defamation libel to social media platforms. It says that the user's speech, you write on Facebook, you write on Twitter, that speech belongs to you, the author of that post. You can be sued if it's libelous, but Facebook cannot be sued, Twitter cannot be sued. If it was otherwise, then social media just would not work if Twitter took on liability for every post. If YouTube took on liability for every video that appeared on the platform, that would be just the end. There's no way they can do front-end moderation. They can do subsequent moderation. If something gets flagged, they can look at it, but they can't. They just cannot approve all content ahead of time. Section 230 makes it so that they don't have to. AI creates very interesting questions, frankly, even from a libertarian standpoint, about what the regulation should be, because this is a product that is created by someone. It's created by Sam Altman, and it's programmed by a company. So it's, you know, different than Facebook just letting me post, because the company is taking more of a hand in designing the product. But of course, they also can't predict how the product will iterate itself, what kind of responses it will give, what kind of images it will create, nor can they predict how you, the user of the product, will use the product to create potentially harmful or illegal or copyright infringing or whatever it is content. So the bottom line is, I think this is a case where we actually, the existing law is unclear. We need either a court to really go over it carefully. Ideally, if, like, I hate to involve legislators, but this is actually something they kind of have to consider, some change, not doing away with any of the existing protections, which is the problem, because both Democrats and Republicans do want to change the existing protections. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, every big name person has said something idiotic like repeal Section 230, even though it is the very thing that gives much content pro-Trump, anti-Trump possibility to exist on social media. So I'm very hesitant to recommend any tweaks or any revisiting of this law at all. Yet it is the case that the law as it exists just does not answer the question of who is responsible and what a legal paradigm would look like for instance, content that does copyright infringement or impersonates you or does something that even a libertarian would say should be prohibited or worked against in some way. Should it be like copyright? After it exists, there's a notice takedown period where they then have to take it down in a certain amount of time. I think that would be the best outcome, frankly, but I'm open to other arguments. But it does actually, unfortunately, need to be worked through by some legal authority because it's just not clear right now.
I don't want to say that it's super straightforward, but in terms of the copyright aspect of this, when you look at the complaints, it's, well, people are mad that AI has scraped a lot of the content in books, right? Like it's read the books, essentially assimilated the information in a huge number of books and other articles into its, you know, into its models. And people say, well, that's copyright infringement. And historically, that has not been the case. You can read 10 books and then write something that summarizes many of, like, all of the facts, all of the arguments in those books. And that is not infringement. You have just learned from them, as long as what you can't do is reproduce the exact text or something that comes very close to the exact text. And that's in some ways an easier standard for copyrighted images, for IP. And this is, I think, where it's actually, it seems to me like at least under existing law, and that's not to say that existing law is ideal or necessarily doesn't need to be changed, but at least under existing law, if GPT or Claude or whatever, any of these AIs are spitting out like Batman comics, straightforwardly, they are Batman, right? They're not even, you've not cloaked in any way, then that is a copyright, that's IP violation. Now, the argument that the AI companies are making is kind of interesting here. They're saying, well, this is basically like an 8-year-old sitting in his room and drawing the Batman comics himself, right? Which they don't go after people for doing that unless they decide to start, you know, printing those 8-year-old's comics and selling them, right? You know, that essentially it's user-generated material. And that's an interesting question. These are big companies that are spitting out copyrighted images. And like, at least under existing law, that aspect of it seems pretty straightforward to me. Is all of the writing that it's doing, that where it learned from the books, that's not illegal. But when it spits out copyrighted IP, does seem to violate the law as it stands right now.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. But even from the, it's not clear then who is the responsible party. If it does spit out the exact Batman comic, is it Sam Altman? Is it the person who told it to do that? Is it somehow the product itself, but the product isn't alive? And
well,
can't
one way to resolve this thing. Is the way that is already happening, which is not through legislation, not through the courts, but through contracts. And in fact, Disney just did a gigantic deal with OpenAI, which you know is the Sam Altman ChatGPT company, so that OpenAI can produce images of some, not all, but some of Disney's copyrighted IP. This made some of Disney's creatives unhappy, right? And they're still not doing image likenesses or voices. So you can't, say, use Mark Hamill's face from Star Wars, but you can now use ChatGPT to legally generate an image of a lightsaber. Right. Things like that, that don't have a kind of a person, a voice, a likeness attached to it. And that's because Disney was like, well, we want in on OpenAI. We think that's the future. And OpenAI was like, we want to be partners with Disney in this so that our product. Yes. Also. And we want to make lightsabers. I think that is a good place to end.
Creating content that is more creatively interesting than what Disney's own creative people are doing. Moana 2, only with a real person and still fake fucking water. I'll leave it there.
I said at the beginning that we were not going to be talking about Wicked and Star Wars, and in fact, we ended up talking about Star Wars and Moana 2. That is, in fact, a very good place to end our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. You can support all of our work here at Reason Magazine, Reason Foundation, the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return in 2026.